This is the Criminal Law Podcast on the topic of punishment and sentencing. And for a criminal law violation, what is it that constitutes a crime as opposed to, for example, a tort or any other type of civil violation? And Professor Hart, in a very famous article, The Aims of the Criminal Law, gave what's a widely accepted description of what distinguishes a crime from some type of civil violation. And as he described it, he said it is conduct which, if duly shown to have taken place, which means proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the elements, that will incur a formal and solemn pronouncement of the moral condemnation of the community. So this is society making a moral judgment. If you engage in this conduct, this is a crime, you are a criminal, and that then means that certain punishments can be imposed, ranging from, at the lower end, a fine or some type of community service requirement, putting in hours to benefit the community, all the way up to life in prison, and in a majority of the states, even the death penalty can be imposed for certain specified offenses. So you have a range of punishments that would be available if a person is convicted. Well, what's the rationale for punishing? If you are subject to this moral condemnation of the community, why are you punished? Well, the two leading theories of punishment, why punishment is imposed and how to calibrate that punishment, are those two theories are deterrence, that you will have both specific deterrence, that the individual defendant will be deterred from future violations, and then a general deterrence, that society itself will see that there will be a punishment imposed for certain conduct, and that will act to deter people from engaging in criminal conduct. The other leading theory, at least today, leading theory of justifying punishment is retribution. That if a person engages in criminal conduct, that society is harmed, not just the victim. The victim can obtain compensation. In fact, there is in both the criminal and civil system mechanisms for compensation, but that society has been harmed, and therefore society has the right, once the person's convicted, to extract, if you will, its own punishment from the person. It can seek to obtain retribution against that person. The other theory that had gained credence in the 1960s and is making a bit of a comeback is rehabilitation. That punishment is a means to an end of rehabilitating a defendant. And you tend to see this especially in the juvenile justice area and in the smaller scale drug conviction area, where you may have people who are addicted or forced by economic circumstances to engage in criminal conduct, and they can be rehabilitated. So any punishment is designed to encourage that type of rehabilitation. Now, you also have other theories that have been offered. Isolation, it's a means to remove a criminal element from society, that there is an educational function on behalf. What courts do, and here is probably the more important point, is that courts use those theories as a means or a vehicle to try to determine what is a just punishment. Now, at one time, and here's where the Dudley and Stevens case comes in, you have the very famous case of the four men are on the boat cast adrift in the South Atlantic, 1,000 miles from the nearest land, and the captain and the first mate end up killing the young man, and then the three of them eat his flesh and drink his blood and use that to survive on the boat, and then two are charged with murder. In England at that time, there was one punishment for murder, and that was death. There was no question of rehabilitation. There was some deterrent effect. Clearly, obviously, retributive justice would be involved, and they were convicted, and the jury had a very hard time saying, look, they were in desperate circumstances, and yet upon that conviction, they were sentenced to death, although their sentence was then commuted. So what is a fair punishment? Well, that's the State versus Jensen case, in which you see the court trying to decide, in this very heinous offense, this very heinous murder where the defendant injected the victim with insulin that would cause insulin poisoning, watched her come close to death for nearly an hour, and the victim died with her very young child there present. So an obviously very heinous offense. And yet, this is also a person who had some good qualities. And in fact, in most everyone, you can find some good qualities. So what do you look at? Do you look at deterrence? Do you look at retribution? Do you look at rehabilitation? You note that the court here viewed all three of those theories in trying to weigh what the appropriate penalty was. Now, in the process of determining that penalty, the role of the lawyers, both the prosecutor and the defense lawyer, is to present information about the defendant that goes beyond just the crime. When deciding whether a defendant is guilty of an offense, the jury only considers evidence that is relevant to that particular alleged violation. So you would not bring in issues about the defendant's character. Is this a good person? Is this a bad person? Have they had, you know, a very difficult upbringing? Things like that would not be relevant to proving that crime. Once a defendant is convicted, then the calculus changes. It's no longer proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but in fact the standard for the judge is a preponderance of the evidence, the much lower, more typical civil standard, and the judge looks to the character of the defendant beyond just what was involved in this particular crime. So in the Jensen case, you see the court taking evidence of her conduct both before the particular killing in this case, and then afterwards, her interaction with her husband's new girlfriend at the time, maybe taking action that it was a little bit threatening. Of course, they bring in, the defense brings in her background, her upbringing, how difficult it was when her husband left her and things like that, as a way of saying, well, look, this is someone who should be given another chance down the road. And the issue here is, you know, what is the sentence? It's not going to be death. That was taken off the table when she pled guilty. Does she get life in prison without the possibility of parole, or should she have that out there? And the judge considers a wide range of evidence, and it comes in and is under the preponderance of the evidence standard, so you're not proving character beyond a reasonable doubt, and the judge ultimately comes to the decision to impose a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. And the appellate court is reviewing this, saying, did the judge abuse his discretion? A very favorable standard for the decision of the judge. To abuse your discretion means that you've really gone beyond the line and you have acted, in effect, unreasonably or even irrationally. And, of course, in this situation, it's clear that the judge had a strong basis to impose a sentence of life in prison without parole. Could you justify a sentence of life in prison with the possibility of parole? Yes. That's the discretion the judge has. In fact, that's the discretion that is provided within the legal system to punish, that once you're convicted, that the judge has a great deal of authority, depending upon the system of punishment that the state or federal government has adopted here, the judge retains a fair amount of discretion to decide, and that's only going to be challengeable if it is unreasonable, if it is an abuse of discretion, a very difficult standard to meet.